You're now listening to the Talking Pictures Podcast, broadcasting from sunny Orange County, California. Filmmaker, journalist, and film historian, Paul Booth.
Aloha, welcome to Talking Pictures. I'm your host, Paul Booth. It is a pleasure, as always, for me to be here today. We're going to be having a special guest on discussing his film that's coming up at Dances with Films. I'm going to let you tell him more about the film and the title, because I'd like to have a little bit of surprise and not do all the talking before the director joins us. This is, first of all, a great film and a very funny film, especially if you work in the film business or have ever worked in the film business. And yeah, it's called After for Hire. And it's going to be playing, Dances with Films is a great festival. If you don't know about it, you're definitely going to want to check it out. And I'm sorry, I'm just pulling information here. I apologize. Sorry about that. A little piece of paper fell out of my hand. So yeah, it's going to be playing at Dances with Films, and I'm going to get you that. While I do that, I'm going to tell you about a couple of films I saw lately that have hit the red box that are considered old already because they're only a few months old. But they're I saw the last of all the great films that came out last year, Reese Witherspoon in Wild, and Julianne Moore in Still Alice, which she got the Oscar for. Great performance. If you know someone who's went through that, it might be tough to watch, but hold on, we have our call coming through. 1 second. Hello, are you with us?
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I
good,
can hear
man. How are you?
Good.
This is Marcus.
I'm good.
Thanks
I'm
for
good. Oh, you know, no problem. You're welcome. Thank you for joining us. And
of course.
I don't want to pronounce your name wrong. I know Marcus is easy to pronounce, but I always ask that the guests say their name so I don't boof it.
Well, what's your guess?
Your
last name is Buoff, right?
Oh, right.
right. Paul Buoff, is that correct?
Hey, you know, Mizell. Might be something to start. Mizell, okay.
Yeah, it's kind of fancy if you say Buoff. But, yeah, it's weird because my parents growing up would refer to us as Mizell. But when you say it by itself, it's always Mizell. I don't know. Say what you want.
I see. Okay, because I looked at it, I didn't know if maybe there was a French thing to it, so I wanted
apparently
it to
is
be
French,
proper.
But I, you know, it's North Carolinian, I believe.
Oh, okay. That's well. This is you know. First of all, and also I want to say a thank you to Jonah for setting this up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jonah's a really nice
the man.
Guy. Yeah, I had met him at last year's Dances with Films, and just a really great guy. Always a pleasure. Always helpful.
Yeah.
And so when he sent me first of all, your film, this film, I was just saying before you came on the air, I didn't even say the title or anything. I just had kind of said that it was about a side of the film business, and we'll go more into the synopsis and stuff without messing up anything. But this was a great satirical look at certain aspects of Hollywood that are so funny. They're funny in the fact that they would go watch a film like this and go back to work the next day and do the same thing.
Go ahead. Sorry about that.
Yeah, go ahead. Oh, no, go ahead.
I'll just say in real life, though, like being on a set, these funny situations that are happening, the funniest part about it is nobody's laughing. You know what I mean? Like it's just awkward, like silence. Like
right.
Like the script like the script supervisor reading, you know, lines for this very serious actor. And the script supervisor is usually like this monotone 50-year-old, you know, white lady who, you know, it's just hilarious. It's funny to me. It's funny to me, but, you know, everybody's just all serious and they don't really kind of see it sometimes. That's the kind of thing that, yeah. you know, brought on an actor for
that
is, sure.
I love that that's so true because script supervisors seem, I mean, I know one good friend of mine I cannot stand referring to as black or white, but she's exactly
right.
like that, and just the chill, and you know, she was doing it for
oh,
a
yeah.
lot of big
they're
films
the best.
And
yeah.
had to get
yeah,
out
yeah.
of it.
Yeah.
So
it's the thing with any crew member that has to kind of get in front of the camera or like kind of get near the front of the camera. You know what I mean? Like having some kind of entertaining thing, but they're not built for that. It's awkward, but it's, you know, it's funny, and everybody ends up smiling at the end of it, you know, and that's kind of what I'm trying to say here.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
Provides comedy.
I like that there was humor to it, because for so many films, they're serious.
Mm-hmm.
They take themselves too serious. I think of, like, David Mamet's State and Maine.
Yeah, which I do love.
Yeah, and Truffaut's Day for Night. I know that's a little bit way more of a serious look at it. But what I really liked about this was just the way you so had some of those. And the good thing about this film that we're discussing today for you listeners is that a lot of the jokes, for me, I felt will completely hit an audience, but then not to be selfish as a director or a filmmaker, some of the jokes truly are just little inside jabs. Like somebody's not going to find funny that an AD is trying to tell a makeup artist what to do. But you see that all the time on set when you see people that are trying to tell people how to do their jobs. And it's kind of like, well,
yeah.
you know, you're an AD, so your job is to wrangle people and keep the time, and your job isn't to say where the facial makeup goes. So really what I wanted to do here is I just wanted to read the brief synopsis. I always like to do just the small synopsis so then you can get into what you would like to talk about, so there's nothing that I possibly ruin by reading a longer synopsis. So
okay.
The synopsis here. It's a romantic comedy. It's got a 90-minute running time, and it dances with films in the narrative fiction feature selection. It's going to be playing, oh, where is that? It was at the top the other day. It's June 2nd at 9:30, right?
June 1st at 2:45, actually.
Oh,
but go to both.
Sorry, I swapped times. I'm sorry.
All
I'm
good.
Such a, I'm,
I think that's Donut. That's
yeah,
Donut's
that's
other film, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, yeah. I'm so.
We've got the much better time slot of Monday at 2:45 in the afternoon.
Yeah,
that's a joke.
Thank you for
I'm
that. Oh yeah, no. This week I never host this bad. So please don't call Jonah after this and say what were you
come
doing.
Come on, no big deal. We're having fun. It's all
okay. So synopsis: being a bald, out of work, and desperate to be seen, Jesse discovers the power of persona in the form of a cheap wig. And hold on, the computer's making a glitch. God, this is so funny. Cheap wig, wearing a part to play. The part can be hairy business. In this industry satire, where status, celebrity, and friendship are all on the line. That's a great synopsis, because that's really what Hollywood seems to be, is celebrity status, and the people that aren't into that are friends. So I really like the way you wrote that synopsis, because I couldn't think of a better way to explain Hollywood. So with that, since we have the director here, let us know what you want to let us know, and we're not censored, and so just feel free to...
Oh, fuck yeah. All right. Well, I guess I'd start with kind of how it all came about. So I had been wanting to, well, I started in North Carolina, from North Carolina. I was gripping for a while. Moved to New Orleans, still gripping. I did short films in the meantime. And I got to L.A. and about 5 years ago. And, you know, through all those experiences, especially being in L.A. and really understanding what ego is all about and persona, you know, finally when I got there, is when I started wanting to do something about, I knew I wanted to do something about Los Angeles, like the L.A. grind of it all, but also like celebrity culture, but within like in a fun, colorful way, not serious. You know, I used to want to do serious movies. Now I don't really want to, I want you to turn the TV on and see my movie like Yes Man or Pineapple Express and be like, let's watch this for the 10th time. You don't really ever want to do that when you have some serious kind of film. But anyway, so I wanted to do an L.A. crime film, wanted to do something about disguise comedy. And a matter of time, I say a few months after I kind of came to that conclusion, I met my neighbor, a guy named Jesse, this beautiful, wonderful, bald man, really nice guy, super sweetheart, likable. But he would tell me these stories. We're sitting on my back porch in like Park La Brea in Hollywood. And, he's telling me like, you know, he's an aspiring actor, but he can't get a break. And he's like telling me stories such as like, yeah, man, I got hit by a bus today. And I said, what do you mean you're hit by a bus? You're talking to me right now. What are you talking about? He said, I was standing there and waiting for the bus, and I was on the sidewalk, and I turned around, and just as the bus's mirror hit me on the back of the head as it was pulling up. I said, what do you mean? Like, so anyway, you know, this is like his everyday life, I come to find out. It was a built-in comedy. I go to meet him at Starbucks, and I'm looking for him, and I see like 6 or 8 like MacBook, you know, shiny MacBooks, you know, like everybody has now. And I'm not making this up. At the end of the 6 MacBooks, I see this like 8-inch, you know, like Dell kind of little mini computer that comes with a regular computer for like a promo, you know. And then I see Jesse's bald head behind it. I'm like, oh my God, you know. So that was those kind of things was really what started to shape, you know, the specifics of this like LA grind, disguised comedy type story. And yeah, we just went from there, pretty much.
Now, do you have, just because I like to, one thing I like to do with the show, so it stays fresh for me also, so I don't know everything, so it's just anything mm-hmm. you just said, are you somewhere in the film that there's a cameo you would like to discuss?
I have 3 cameos, only because we didn't have any extras. There was no one else that could have done it. But also, you know, I like to kind of... I'm just kidding. Yeah, I have... What's that?
That's indie film. You write, produce, direct, order the catering.
Crafty, yeah, for sure. But it's also fun. I mean, it's nice to be in there. You don't really think about it when you're acting as a director or writer or whatever. But at the end, you know, when you're sitting down watching it and you forget about all the work, it's really cool to kind of see yourself, you know, be a part of it on screen with everybody else. But there's 3 cameos. I have, what is it? The first one is, man, I got to think about this. So there's this John Dreas. So there's a character named John Dreas. He plays Jesse's new roommate. And as soon as Jesse gets gets accepted by John Dreas to be his roommate, John Dreas disappears. For like the whole like middle of the movie, like you have no idea where this guy is. They have an eviction notice on the door. He hasn't paid the rent. You know, what you thought was the best, coolest roommate ever ends up being the worst roommate ever. He finally reappears, and they're like, "Where have you been?" And he says, "You mean where my character has been?" Because he's a method actor. You know, he just gets lost in character. Anyways, there's this scene where you see, you then see like where he's been. It's like a little subplot, little flashback in the middle to kind of keep it easy and fun. And he's this detective character, and it's this black and white film noir. And you see where, like, you know, he's like lost downtown LA. You know, he's saying I was hiding out. You know, it's all this gruffy voiceover. He's got this like trench coat and this fedora on. He's being followed. He ends up being captured and put in this white passenger van. And as he's telling the audience and Jesse and the friends, you know, where have you been? He says, I realized actually I was lost in character, and this was the production team kidnapping me to bring me back to set. And so that's when it's funny. That's when you see me pop up as like a PA, just, you know, no lines or anything, but just my side of my big old head with like a walkie on, and you know, we've got John Dres back on set. So that was my first cameo. I have two more, which you can just watch the movie. You'll see.
Yeah, no, you guys definitely got to come check this out. Again, it's Monday, 1:45, and that date, Dances with Stones, I think, expanded a few days this year, because I don't remember them being like 8 days last year. It seems like a shorter experience.
I think it's 11 days. I think it's 11 days long now, and it's at 2:45 on June 1st, Monday. It's Monday, but I'm glad that, you know, I'm glad that it's not 5 p.m. I'm glad that it's before the rush hour traffic. You know, it's like, hey, man, like, Monday afternoon, what else would you want to do but go see this fun movie? Because you don't want to be at work. That's boring. Just take it off. Or just like, you know, just like,
take your
lunch break. Take a 90-minute lunch break.
Just like on a Sorrel series. Get out of work.
Exactly.
No,
there's
baseball. I
agree. There's day movies. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
We're very excited. Yeah. Very excited.
And is this, first feature as director?
No, this is actually the second one. We did one back in North Carolina about 5 years ago called Half Empty with my good friend Troy Carlton. We wrote and directed it, and that was also a comedy, crime comedy kind of. It's about, you know, it's these two guys that kind of switch. It's like a Trading Places type story. So now we did that back in the day as well. Did that one for like, I think, $12,000, and we actually shot this one for super cheap as well, which I'm most proud about. I don't know if I should tell the budget. People are like, I don't know if you want to tell people your budget, but I kind of do. You can coax it out of me if you want, but whatever. But, you know, it's, you know,
well,
and look, everybody has to do it now this way. I know, you know, micro budget city, like everybody. It's not really a brand new story. I get that, but it's still something to be proud about. You know, when you do, just complete it. It's amazing what you can get done for such a low amount of money, as long as you know, have the time to be able to do it, you know. So.
Well plus, it's amazing what can be done. And, well, I mean, now the way things are so much changing with crowdfunding and Kickstarter and,
yeah.
And, I mean, when I made films like that, and left when it was still, you had to find an investor and you had to figure out exactly when they were going to get their money back, and you had to get and you just did the donation way, and so there wasn't a way that you could really go to all your buddies and say,
pretty impossible, I guess.
Hey, you have $5. And so if you have $5, then that'll still help, because 200 people giving $5 is $1,000, so, you know,
and you know what? Well, you know, this was actually a web series pilot first that we did do a Kickstarter or Indiegogo for. We shot off like $500 for like this little 5-minute pilot. People really liked it. And by people, I mean like 12 people. my grandma loved it. But, we made a second one.
Oh, it's so funny that you said that. I was just going to say, I've always said if I can make a film that someone besides my grandma sees, I'll be happy.
You know, I mean, that's a good barometer, though. It's like, grandma's got to give you a thumbs up. My grandma hasn't even seen it. Anyways, we made a second episode, and I realized, I want to make a feature. Let's make a feature out of this. We've already got, let's take our first 12 minutes, that is our web series, and use that as our first 12 minutes of the film, and I'm going to develop and write this script, and turn it into a feature. And we ended up actually keeping, I think, minutes like 5 through 12, or 5 through 14 is that second episode of the web series, which is still red camera. Like, we shot it high quality, sound was good, all that stuff. But the first 5 minutes we reshot. We didn't keep that same pilot. And but the point is, we just, you know, we maximized what we had, and we went from there. And as far as the remaining 75 minutes, I had my good friend Dustin Taylor come on board. He was super, super excited about being a part of anything that I was doing, thankfully. And he threw in the money that we needed. Not a lot, but definitely enough. So friends, good friends. Well, this is good place.
This is interesting because I'm not when I say this here, I want you to know that there's a Hollywood has an issue of people, you know, being bugged or hit up for favors. So,
yeah.
You know, with your permission, I'd like to mention some of your bio here, but yeah. I don't want to make audience think that means you can come up and because you did stuff for Interscope that you're going to give them Dr. Dre's phone number. I just love hearing that when you know someone 5 minutes and they're like, let me introduce you to someone you took 15 years to meet. So basically, directing music videos for Interscope, mm-hmm. And recording artists, Atlantic. Mm-hmm. We have directed over 30 short films, and the award-winning crime comedy feature Half Empty, which was discussed. He just completed his second feature film, obviously, that we've been talking about. 7 years in lighting and camera department for over 50 mm-hmm. major productions across the U.S., including 21 Jump Street. Now, that was... and then also... Actually, you know, this is kind of fun, interesting. Now that I'm reading this, was Percy Jackson Sea of Monsters in Vancouver?
They shot, I think, half of that or a certain amount of that in Vancouver. Then they came to New Orleans and shot all, like, the theme park stuff, which I worked on.
Oh, okay, because I was going to say, a good buddy of mine was on that, so that would have been a small world if you guys were on the same crew together. So that's why I saw that.
Okay.
I went, oh, hey,
he was in,
my buddy Warren was on
he was
that.
He was up in Vancouver, though.
Right? Yeah, he's in Vancouver, yeah.
Damn, I wish I could switch places with him, because New Orleans at night is not fun. New Orleans, abandoned theme park, at night, in the summer. Yeah, I'm good. I don't need to do that again. I'm good.
Yeah, it's funny how they don't, when you sign your starter paperwork, they don't tell you anything that you're in store for.
Oh, God.
And so this is really great, and now I'm starting, this is making more sense, because I purposely, okay. like I said, to not spoil anything, didn't look over what your background was, because I like to, I don't like to have judgments about a filmmaker before I watch something. So I want to see what they do and then go backwards. So this kind of experience gives you that perfect eye of how you nailed those set nuances, those inside jokes, just the you know, and it's not ruining anything, but just some of those little things with the casting. So this was, I mean, congratulations that you've done so well and been so successful in the film business, because we all know it's a hard
thank
business to get into, let alone to stay in.
Thank you.
It's almost easier to get kicked out of than to get into, I say it sometimes as a joke. And then, of course, you have a producer who has an MFA from AFI, which...
Mm-hmm.
You know, we do have listeners in other states that wouldn't know that AFI is the American Film Institute, and that's like, I don't really think there's a much better film school than that, or program. Mm-hmm. You're mentored by, like, Oscar-winning professionals or famous mm-hmm. people come to your class and talk, so you really get a chance to learn. Also here, she was recognized as one of the top 35 under 35 by the Hollywood Reporter, and mm-hmm. her credits include executive producer, soon to be released, Dark Places, starring Charlize Theron. So mm-hmm. this is really cool, because I only mentioned this as I read down. And also she was a co-producer on End of Watch with Jake Gyllenhaal, which I actually mm-hmm. missed because I have an eye condition that I can't see movies that are too shaky. And because I have epilepsy, so it's like some movies bother me. And that was like the only thing that disappointed me when the doctor told me I couldn't do. And then Snitch with Dwayne Johnson, who, of course, he's from Hawaii. I'm from Hawaii, so it's always nice to see Dwayne Johnson continuing to have success. So this is really...
That's actually where we met on that film, Snitch. I met Jillian on
that
film.
You working on it?
I was a grip, yeah, on that. That was the last little, one of the last ones I worked on as a grip about 3 years ago, probably four, I don't know, whatever it was, three or three and a half years ago. Yeah, she was an executive at the production company that made that film, and I was a grip on it. And we just, you know, that's how kind of cool that, you know, her sets are, like, you know, the kind of people and the dynamic that she brings together. People, there's really not much of a hierarchy there. People were talking to people no matter what their, you know, job positions were, which you know, made it for an awesome, like, the best show I ever worked on in my life. Dwayne Johnson, the man, by the way. Nicest actor I've ever met in my life. But,
yeah, he's,
but yeah.
The thing is with me, it's, I know so many people in Hawaii that know him, and I used to run a student film festival, and I actually invited him to it because my friend was his driver on the rundown. So she gave the letter to him personally because, of course, the agents and the managers didn't want to give it to him. And long story short, he had came up to a friend of mine at the wrap party and was like, "Hey, did your friend that give me that letter, is he here?" And she was like, "No." And she's like, "I need you to tell him personally that I have a pay-per-view that month. Otherwise, I would be there. And I'm not just ignoring him because he's a student. And I'm not just ignoring him because I'm busy." And literally, long story short, 2 days later, I got a personal handwritten letter from him. So
that sounds like,
I just wanted to go ahead.
I was going to say, that sounds like him, yeah. He actually knew everybody's name on the set by day three, which is insane. I mean, he was a little he was a little rusty, but he was trying so hard to just be, you know, to be appreciative, which you don't see, man. You can see that much, those kind of level, that level of an actor.
I didn't mean to go off on that. I just wanted people to know that what's cool about this movie, that this movie comes from a cool place and comes from, you know, Hollywood has no doubt earned its bad reputation, but when you really get out there, you find that there's not as many good people as there are bad, but there's a high percentage of good people that there are that do things. So I really wanted to talk about this film and have you on here because I'm constantly thinking of how people have a specific perception of Hollywood, and everyone's a jerk, and no one's friendly, and everyone just wants the money, and that's not the truth. You're there, and when you get on the right crew and everything clicks, it's like, it's the best.
Absolutely. It is the best. It's the best.
In terms of getting this together, with obviously not sharing anything private, how does this relationship with your producer work? In these days, how did that come about, other than just you had crewed for her before? I mean, how does that?
We ended up dating, actually, after Snitch. You know, but she...
You said
very,
it didn't ask.
I'm so, what's that?
I said, you said it, I didn't ask.
Oh, yeah. No, that kind of helps it make a little more sense. Started dating, but she is a big, I think she never forgot, like, why she does what she does, and she just kind of keeps it real. I mean, that's the best way to say it. And she supported me, like, more than, you know, I could ever ask for since then. And, you know, I wouldn't have been able to make this movie Actor for Hire if it wasn't for her. And if it wasn't for Dustin, my buddy / investor, you know, so no matter how much you know or how much you think you know or how much, you know, how hard you work, you still always, even if you write it, direct it, shoot it, produce it, edit it, market it, you still need some help. You still need some people to come, you know, from the sides and support you and, you know, tell you some things sometimes. And she's definitely one of those. Yeah. Jillian's helping hand for sure.
Well, I'd only mentioned that because I know there's a real movement right now with you know, the ACLU talking about suing about less women making films, and they're being kind of the surgent now of female directors. So I only wanted to mention that I thought it was cool that you were working with a female producer, because you're showing that not all of us men just hire men, or
right.
It's a frustrating thing to hear, because projects I've done, every project I've ever worked on, my boss was a woman got me on the show. My top mentors are women, best paid gigs I've ever got were from a woman. So I'm always like, I can see where it is a man's industry, but none of my friends are half as powerful as the women I know.
So, well, I know it's,
No, go ahead.
Well, I know it's like a popular, not popular, but it's like a hot topic to be able to, women, minorities and women, and like people need to be heard, and they need, but for me, and everybody needs to be heard. But for me, I really honestly don't even think about female, male, straight, gay. Like, it's like, are you capable of like doing this with me? It's really as much. If I was picky like that, I wouldn't get anything done, first of all. But bottom line is like, what are you capable of doing? And like, how, Jillian is if she was a man, it would be the same thing. We'd be here talking about him right now. It's just, the fact is, like, let's make a movie. That's all it is, Very interesting that people get up on that, on the whole, gender and the sexual preference of it all. It really doesn't make any sense to me. But that being said, I think it's great that we can make an example, or like, just it's definitely a good look, and it's a good thing for sure. That's, we got some a mixture of things going on here as far as the production team is concerned.
To me, I'm very interested in, and I mean, of course, the film had a wide variety of everything, and I'm not someone who looks at any kind of race, culture, creed, whatever. So I really just mentioned it to keep it as something that's relevant to this week's episode in terms of news, not directed at you. But basically, I mean, it's kind of like what you're saying about what she's done for you. It's like, I don't have any friends that are on a top 30 list of Hollywood Reporter Variety, so it's a really interesting thing. So I'm glad that we have directors out there that don't think who can do what or not, and that's a really good thing. Another question I had for you was how many drafts were there of the script, or how much of this was improv? Because it had such a, it just had such a natural, real flow to it.
Good.
I'm not saying someone couldn't
script
that, but it had that feeling like when you're on set and something just crazy or stupid happens, What was the deal?
Well, so I feel like that's how you want, that's how I want my thing, my movies to be. I mean, you don't want to like, you want it to feel like it's organic like that. But the process is usually like this, and it was with this one as well. You sit and you write the script based on like comic gags or like whatever it is you're trying to do. You pick your structure. We went with the hero's journey. We kept it simple. I also applied like a lot of, comedy devices that you've seen in a lot of other movies. The movie called Tootsie, I'm sure you've seen it, Dustin Hoffman. It's like the best disguised comedy. It's like what Mrs. Doubtfire was in the 90s. I use a lot of that. Like, it's like, even though we're talking about a guy with a wig, it's still the same kind of structure, comic structure, as far as disguised comedy. Anyway, so I figure all that stuff out, and then as I'm writing dialogue, I try to just be the characters or whatever. I really don't try to make a big fuss about it. I just try to do it and not overthink it and kind of let it come out. And a lot of this is like, the strength a lot of times is in the gag that you've set up, So by the time you have the script to a pretty good place, like, I think third draft is whenever I felt really good. I mean, this script came together. It just came out and came together really easily, which is always wonderful. Excuse me. And So we get everybody to rehearse. We get everybody together. That's really a key thing. And that's when you, you know, you figure out who you want to cast, who's going to be your cast, and then you get together to rehearse. That's when you have to really kind of give up the character to this actor. To a degree, I mean, you're kind of like the, you're, you know, you're the boss or whatever. You're the guy that says good or bad or whatever, but still, like, it's their character now, too. Once you do that, if you've casted correctly, then you definitely, you get that organic outcome, you know, hopefully. That's the idea, anyway. So it's wonderful that you even say that, because that was the idea. It's kind of how we do that.
Oh, yeah. And I think it'll be real interesting to see with what it does with audiences who haven't been on a film set or near a trailer or seen ADs walking around with headsets and to kind of experience some of those things, because that's where I was just kind of like, as much it was, as I knew it had to be scripted, and it couldn't have been, it was almost like, and I'm not saying this in a bad way, but it was almost, it almost felt like it couldn't be scripted as well as it came off, but it couldn't be like improv as well as it came off. So it felt like this weird mixture of like, you know, what did he do?
Well, can I say one thing too before
oh, yeah.
Like I really think that a good filmmaker's job is sometimes, especially, you know, to like, maybe not draw attention to yourself, you know, but like put it all on screen. Think about the characters and the world. You know what I mean? So like, that's good that you say that, because it makes me feel like I did that. Also, one thing I forgot to mention is all the characters, all the real cast with the characters, they have the same name. I kept their all the cast's first name. Just it's kind of like a Seinfeld approach, just to kind of like keep them. Just really kind of like put a stamp on, hey, you're playing a version of yourself here. You're not really going to be acting here. You're playing a version of yourself. It's just you're in this situation, and you're going to say it like this. What do you think? And we go from there. But they all had their real names, their real first names. I think that really kind of helped as far as what we're talking about.
Oh, okay. That's a really interesting approach. I've actually not really heard people use that. I never really talk about myself on the show, but I've been an independent filmmaker for 15 years, and I've crewed a number of studio gigs. So I that was why now I picked up on a lot of stuff that might have just went by. But it was great. This idea that you're doing with teamwork is really great, because that's really what our show is about and why we started it, because we wanted filmmakers to come on that are about team and that are about acknowledging that it took more than just them, and we are all until we learn kind of sold this. I call it a bill of goods that you know, a Martin Scorsese film is just him hanging the lights and pulling focus and telling De Niro what to do, and I don't think Scorsese would be good if he had to do all that. So it's cool to hear, and then when I see these, you know, see these bios that you have, to see that you're able to take all that you had and do something really cool and unique with it that wasn't just maybe making fun of a bad experience or making something that, you know, that you have a mean producer and everyone knows that that's who you're talking about. And then, you know, to have a great producer with credits like this is really amazing. And as we, the other thing I was really interested in was I constantly hear stories about it being tough to film in Los Angeles. What was the permitting thing like?
You know, I have no idea what a permit looks like, to be honest with you. I found it to be the easiest thing to shoot in Los Angeles. I'm comparing it to shooting in North Carolina and in New Orleans. North Carolina, now, you could shoot pretty much anywhere also, and you can get permission because people are just so pumped and excited and, like, you know, to help you out. L.A., it's like, if you keep it small and you almost, you know, you don't approach the actual movie like a student film, but if you appear to be a student film, you know, like, you know, if you're outside shooting and you're only shooting like a DSLR, put a camera strap over your neck. Look unofficial. That's how you get this stuff done. I mean, permits and all that, that's you're on somebody else's timetable at that point, and you're also, you know, you have to play by other people's rules, and you can't get anything done that way with this kind of filmmaking. For example, there's a scene in the film where Jesse's in Union Station. Hopefully I'm not telling on myself, but whatever. There's a scene in the Union Station, and it's Jesse thinking about going home and all this. And we, you know, we filmed it on a little GH4, a little 4K, little cheap camera. It looks good, though. But I had a strap on my neck. It was me and the little camera, and Jesse sitting across from me. And we shot it, and it's montage. We didn't have any music. I mean, we didn't have any dialogue, so it was no big deal. But when you watch the film, it's like, wow, how did you get a permit for this? Or how did you guys shoot in here? And, you know, it's like, we didn't. We just went and shot it. It's kind of like the smoke and mirrors these days, I feel like. You got to be creative. But I have no idea what a permit, looks like, to be honest. I have no idea.
I love that. It's just, yeah, just take your shots. I remember when I listened to the Midnight Cowboy commentary, one of the producers was saying, how'd you get so many, some of these great shots? And he just said, we had the cameraman duck down in a car and we stole them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it was like, yeah, we were going to go through all it took to get stuff in New York when we could just park a car, tell the guy to duck down. All you really do is have to get the lens out the window. Yeah. And then you have all these iconic shots of New York City, right?
Yeah, I think it's that creativity that nobody ever sees or hears about unless we're talking about it right now, you know. But that's the fun stuff, man. That's the, like, how are we going to get this? And at the end of that day, you're always like, yeah, we're smart, you know. You feel smart, but you got it, you know. As opposed to, like, some people, I think sometimes make the mistake of just when they're starting out, they feel like they have to get all these things before they can even shoot anything, like a permit. And I get it. I mean, that's smart, and that's like being a professional. But sometimes, you know, if you don't have much money, which means you don't have much time, then, you know, you have to be more creative than that. And some people that get the permits and get these things lined up and all this paperwork, but then they never even shoot because they're in this kind of, like, you know, they're tied up a little bit. You know, it's all about kind of maintaining, well, like, what's important.
Well, plus, do you have what I like that filmmakers do, because you don't come off sounding like it, but what's cool is that you did some things, now that you've explained to me what part of that process was, you've done some things in the film that weren't, and this is what so many filmmakers would do that I've seen, heard, talked to, even know, don't work with, but know, is it wouldn't be, what can we get? It would be walking into an office saying, my producer is such and such, and she knows such and such, and she's done such and such, so give me what I want. So
nobody cares in LA. Yeah.
So to pull back from that and still see how to do your own thing and do what and get your vision, and not just rely on that you have a producer with huge credits or from AFI, is something that I just want to say I really respect, because that's constantly what you always hear with filmmakers is, you don't hear about this story, you don't hear about what they did, you just hear about who was in it, or who they know that's powerful that got them something.
And to be fair, to be fair, so I'd say maybe, I don't know, percentage-wise, it was 75% of us kind of doing that Union Station route, that kind of guerrilla style. But, you know, we had a red camera, and we had a sound guy, and we had one extra hand. We had a three-person crew on this movie. But the other 25%, because I did sound on a documentary once, and I realized I don't think the sound turned out too good either. But as we were shooting the documentary, I realized, like, man, you can do a lot. You can make things look really nice if you understand how to use what's there lighting-wise, and then adding maybe a bounce or a little light and call it a day, and then also just get some good sound. You can do so much. That's the approach that we use with this movie. You can't, again, with the permit stuff, you can't get a crew. You can't have a big crew and expect to move fast anyways. And if you can't move fast, then you're not getting much done. And that means we couldn't have shot this thing in 16 days. Anyways, my point is, so Jillian, though, you know, although she, I'd say 25% of it was, like, her really pulling her weight. I mean, the there's this the producer's office that we shot in is actually the office that she worked in. And we came in on a Sunday night, and shot that. And the biggest thing is the post production that she, you know, the help that she provided. There's a woman named Nancy Kerhofer who's amazing. She's a good friend now through Jillian who helped us out with all that stuff. You know, we got colored at eFilm. We got a sound mix at the dub stage. We got, you know, just things like that. I mean, Nancy Kerhofer was, she's like post-production soup on like The Prestige and Memento and all these things. And now she's helping me out, you know, because of Jillian, because she believes in me. So, yeah, I mean, we did have help. I mean, there was some kind of like things like that. But as far as the production of it, yeah, it was definitely guerrilla for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just like because it felt, and as I'm playing it back now, with the more that you tell me and knowing that you had some of these, you know, ace cards and that you didn't use them all the time, is really interesting because I think I've become so detached from any short that I work on or any short that I do or film that I work on here, it's with someone in another state or place. And like, I'm a consulting producer and I get some things done for them that they can't or whatever. And so I don't, I haven't gotten the experience to go through trying to get it done here simply because it's the competitiveness that we both know. It's not about not having the guts to do it or the integrity, but it's like,
right,
you want to make a film and you're not just doing it because you want to make a better film than the guy next to you. Like, you want to actually make a good film.
Absolutely.
And so so that was executed so well that I didn't feel like this was like, oh, we can make the coolest movie ever about some behind-the-scenes stuff, or we're going to just bash this casting director, or we're going to make fun of ADs. It was very, very well thought out. So in tying into the script process question, this was a 16-day shoot, and so how long was basically the editing? Like, what was this process? Mm. How long was this basically from concept to editing?
Okay. So the concept, here's the thing. Concept, I had been thinking about this for about a year and a half. We shot that web series pilot about a year before we shot the rest of the feature. So there was a year between that pilot and the feature, production of the feature, where I was just kind of sitting on it and thinking about it and all that stuff. And then when I sat down to write it, it came out. That's why it came out so nicely, and, you know, because I knew what I had built, so many kind of story ideas and things in my head. So I'd say about a year, though. You got to still say that year was a year of concept and thinking, conceptualizing. And then after that, I mean, look, after the script was done, we shot about a month later, which was, I think, June of last year. So about a year ago now, we hadn't even shot the thing yet. We shot over 16 days, but the trick with that was we didn't shoot, obviously, 16 days straight. This is the only way, Austin, I could get this thing to work. I would shoot 3 or 4 days a week, and then I would take a week and a half off to prep and to prep the next 3 or 4 days of shooting. And then we would do that, you know, and then we would repeat that process for, I think, 5 times until it was done. And then we had a day or two of pickup shots and stuff like that. But, I mean, you can't really prep a whole entire movie without having a team of people. I mean, you could try, but it didn't make any sense. Breaking it up like that in 3 or 4 day chunks every week and a half was the kind of way to do it. So, and then I didn't fully answer your question. So the editing, I had a rough cut done. I was editing while I was shooting, which is very nice because we had that week and a half. But I would say I spent 3 months on edit, 3 or 4 months maybe editing. Like, I just think I did like 12 cuts. Oh my god, I'm kill myself just thinking about it. And then, of course, we go into sound mix. I learned how to also be, I'm not going to call myself a post-production supervisor. Nancy Kerhofer and all her people really helped me out, like these sound mix people and all this. But you know, I had to learn how to, like, export OMF files. I had to, you know, learn how to export, you know, for color and, like, you know, all this stuff. I mean, I learned so much just because I had to do it myself. And I'd say the timetable of that, we had it handed over for color and mix by January, mid-January. And it was completely done mid-February, I guess. And we got out of the festival. Yeah.
That's really, that's really amazing. Films either get stuck in the having to go too quick, some films get dragged out too long, and then you're kind of, you lose sight of vision if you're not specifically dead on. You know, it's cool to let some things brew, but I think sometimes it's where people, then they change the vision because they saw a film that inspired them, so now it's got to be like, So that's a cool thing that you got to do. And so basically, because we also like to acknowledge crew on this show, another reason we started this show was to, we've had crew guests and we'll have more, is to let people out there that are interested in movies understand that there is dolly grips and there is guys that hang lights and there is, so since you kind of come from that background, other than just obviously it lent to you, is there a specific situation where you could be like, oh my gosh, like, had I not learned that on show XYZ, I would be screwed right now. But since I learned that, now I'm doing it. Like, from a crew point of view, you as the director.
Yeah. I think it's more of a bulk of like constantly seeing what the pattern is of like what do the professionals do as far as, look, the whole reason I became a grip is to really understand. I was always like, well, how do they make it look the way they make it look? That's the question I remember asking myself. So stupid sounding now, but you know, like, how do they make it? Like, what's the deal with, you know? So, you know, gripping is camera support, you know, as far as dolly and cranes. You know, if you see a camera moving in a movie, that's the grip that's moving that camera. You know, and also lighting, you know, like we come in and shape the light. You know, you want light on this but not on this. Okay, here we come. Things like that. But also, like, even as any kind of crew member, not just the grip, if you work on enough sets, you really do observe a ton, you know, and you learn what looks good and what doesn't, you know, as far as, even just looking over the DP's shoulder, you know, on 50 productions, you kind of get a sense, if you're paying attention, you get a sense of what looks good. So that does help overall, that general thing right there, not to mention knowing how to rig a camera to a car for super cheap is very helpful without having to pay $500 a day for a grip to come do it. you know what I mean? Like, I would say like, just knowing how to, like, at least having a, even if it's not the absolute correct way, it's the way I think it looks good. Having some kind of preference, having some kind of strong opinion on what you think looks good, you know, and then being able to put the camera where you need to put it when you're the guy putting it, you know, putting it in a place. When you have three people, a lot of times you're the one that's putting it in a place. And, you know, the thing with Active for Hire is we weren't able to move the camera a lot, you know, because it costs money. You do need a crew for that. It's something you can't really do on your own properly. You need a focus puller. You need a dolly grip. You need the actual camera support system, whatever it might be, dolly, whatever. So, you know, of course, early on you make the decision. You know, you built the shooting style into, like, what do you have to work with. So, yeah, we're going to be static here. We're not going to move the camera, and that's okay. We're going to have handheld. We're going to have some tripod stuff, and we might have a couple of pans. But, you know, you make that decision, but that doesn't mean you can't light it decently. It's not the best look thing, but it does look pretty good because we understand the concept of decent lighting. So, yeah, I mean, I would say overall, my just overall experience being on sets, it just lets me know what I can and can't get away with.
Right. Well, I mean, that's I really am glad that you had this much experience as we got to go through your bio, because I think a lot of people, I mean, even filmmakers, until they learn, think that directors, you know, just direct, and unless you're that lucky guy, I was remotely not Quentin Tarantino. A friend of mine is a friend of his, and so that's like your rare occasion where you didn't have to go through the food chain, and then 20 years later get to direct a film. Paul Thomas Anderson probably would be another example, but of course he was born in the entertainment industry with his dad working on that America's Funniest Home Video show, so You got to watch and learn and observe. Yeah, that was apparently what I read once was that guy who would introduce the show and introduce Bob Saget was Paul Thomas Anderson's dad. He was a television personality. So as a kid, P.T. Anderson would get to hang around studio a lot.
That explains Magnolia. That explains big time that awesome sequence in Magnolia.
Yeah, I mean, it explains why your first two films are better than some films that people were making 20 years and made a film. Speaking of, I just wanted to tell you something interesting. When you mentioned The Grip, my mentor's husband was The Grip that did that infamous Boogie Nights shot in the opening. And so it's funny because he's a very modest guy that literally will not talk about himself other than to say hi to you. And so I just laugh because every time I see him, I'm like, can we talk about Boogie? He's like, nope. Can we talk about Matt Smith?
Yeah.
Nope.
That's cool.
And
that's
just
so
like,
cool.
Please, just one. So I mentioned that because I wanted to say that I can feel where your film came out has a real great team thing. Mm-hmm. And especially now seeing all of your experience of working on so many great shows, being around so much great talent, and then mm-hmm. I mean, to have a producer who was a part of the Oscar winning Undefeated and who has been around big talent and who, let's face it, both of you guys could very easily have monstrous egos because of your credits and who you've worked with. And I'm not saying that in a bad way. So I appreciate that you're out there doing it the way it should be done, which is respecting people and respecting their talent and giving them something good to watch, you know?
And that makes me very happy that you see it that way.
Yeah, so if you have, because we're down to the last 2 minutes here, if you have a website that you can plug for this, feel free.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, it's just simple as actorforhiremovie.com, and if you go there, you'll see immediately the ticket link for our screening on June 1st, which is a Monday at 2:45 p.m. We're going to have a Q&A there. It's going to be all the cast and crew. It's going to be a really good time. Actorforhiremovie.com.
Actorforhiremovie.com, okay, and you're going to have cast and crew screening, and please, just so I note, because I've been covering festivals for 5 years and have had films in festivals. To note to the audience, please, respect filmmakers' time when they're at a Q&A. Once they leave and they're in the lobby, they're on their private time, and it's cool if they want to be approachable, but I like to let people know to not think that they're going to the lunch afterwards to celebrate and let people have their space. That's what I always see as journalists, is journalists going up and bugging the filmmakers, and it's like, they're enjoying their day. Let them enjoy their day. They did their Q&A. They were respectful of giving us time. So with that, we're going to say thank you for joining us, Marcus. You have a wonderful day. I'll definitely introduce you to, I'll introduce myself to you if I make it out, but, thank you for what you're doing and best wishes with this screening.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it so much.
Oh, yeah, no problem. You take care.
I'll see you at the screening now.
Okay, will do.
All right.
Bye. And thank you for joining us, Marcus. We really appreciated that. This was a really cool film. I wish I could have talked about it more, but I didn't want to spoil anything. I don't mean me talking. I mean just in general, because you're going to love it. Actor for Hire, very qualified director, qualified producer, great crew. Come out and enjoy it. Monday, 1:45, Dances with Films, June 1st. And with that, I'm going to sign off and say thank you for joining me. As always, whatever you do, make sure and watch a good movie tonight. Take care and aloha from all of us at Talking Pictures.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Pictures Podcast, real conversation and movie-induced inspiration.